Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 12th. For our interview this week, we traveled up to the Upper West Side here in Manhattan to sit down with Stephen Adley Geergas, a playwright who has written a number of plays, including The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, which Father Jim Martin, editor here, has written about in his book, A Jesuit Off-Broadway, and also the new play, The Little Flower of East Orange. Stephen is suffering from a bad back, so we really appreciate that he sat down with us, but we met with him in his apartment. All right, this is Tim Reedy. I'm here with Stephen Adley Geergas, the author of many plays, including The Little Flower of East Orange, which is now playing down at the Public Theater here in New York. Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for agreeing to meet with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Stephen and I are here in his apartment in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Now, you know, some of our listeners may not be familiar with all of your plays. I'll name a few of them here. We've got Our Lady of 121st Street, The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, Jesus Hopped the A-Train, and of course The Little Flower of East Orange, which is now playing downtown, as I said. Maybe you could talk about some of the themes that you're interested in, that you've explored over the years in these plays.
Yeah, well, when I'm writing a play, I guess I'm never or rarely consciously exploring a theme. I guess I've come to sort of think about it that I write about what keeps me up at night. And certainly the spiritual life is something that keeps me up at night, or rather that journey, you know. So that's a theme that I keep returning to. And then there's a line from St. Paul, which I paraphrase, like I can't say exactly, you know, when I became a man, I put away childish things. And that's a line that's actually quoted in Our Lady of 121st Street. But I think that that's also thematically something that I'm returning to. Kind of akin to the spiritual journey is the journey of shedding those childhood things and embracing, you know, life as a, you know, as a mature and open-eyed adult as I can.
Yeah.
And that those two struggles tend to go hand in hand, so they show up a lot in my work.
Now, just looking at the titles of these plays, for our audience, they would see that they have a distinctly Catholic flavor. What is it about the Catholic tradition that kind of inspires you, that you know, makes you return to these subjects?
Well, I grew up Catholic. That's the nest that I was I was nurtured in. You know, I suppose if I grew up in India, it would be, you know, but so that's the starting point. And I don't know if it's the ending point, but it's certainly the starting point. I think that that I'm one of those Catholics that has a lot of questions, that's run up against a lot of issues, and at the same time, if I hear someone else questioning or belittling the faith past a couple of paragraphs, then I'm instantly on the defense. I think it's you know, anyway, that's sort of where I started from. I went to Catholic grammar school for 8 years, and then Catholic high school for another 2 years, and
Corpus Christi, right here in Manhattan,
up on 121st, and that was really, it was a great place. I mean, I didn't go to a, I didn't have the experience where the nuns would beat you and you know, and stuff like that. Although one of the nuns had a shillelagh, which is a, you know, stick with points, and she would use it, but it was a very loving and nurturing atmosphere. So that when I came up against stuff that I couldn't reconcile in the faith, it was almost harder because there was so much love, and yet there was other stuff that just confounded me. I don't know if I was too little to ask questions or talk openly or whatever, but that certainly was, at least grammar school was an environment where it was extremely nurturing and loving, and they could have probably fielded those questions.
And Corpus Christi is a school that has a great reputation for fostering, at least early on, they were known for a more progressive approach to education. So I think you had a unique experience.
It was a wonderful place when I went there too, because it was just like the city, you know, it was all colors, shapes, sizes, and And it was awesome.
And George Carlin, another alumnus of
the Scripps. That's right. And what's his face? Jim's favorite saint.
Thomas Merton, of course.
Thomas Merton.
Yeah, that was the scene of where he was baptized and, yeah. and the scene of his conversion. One other sort of trend in your plays, and Jim Martin, who you just mentioned, is a colleague at American Magazine, writes about a bit in his book, A Jesuit Off-Broadway, is that in your plays, I mean, I've seen Last Days and also Little Flower, I mean, there's a use of, I guess, coarse language would be the best way to describe it. Do you find that using language like that kind of helps you get at some of these truths that you're trying to explore and makes people more receptive to them, perhaps?
I think it depends. I guess I would say that that I would put those two plays separate.
Okay.
And I would say that with Judas, I started writing it from a specific place, which had to do with being at Corpus Christi and getting to about the second or third grade and hearing the story about Judas, and just my faith sort of came to a standstill because they don't say, and then he went to hell, but they don't say that he didn't go to hell. They're like, we don't know where he went, but it wasn't good, you know? And as a little kid, I didn't understand, and because I was a child, how God would be unable to forgive someone or, kind of pull them out of the mud and back into the light. And even though it was a little kid issue, it was the basis for a lot of stuff that followed. So when I started writing that play, in terms of the spiritual journey, I was like, all right, why don't I just go back to where it all started, which is Judas, and do the research and explore my feelings, this and that, and make this piece. So that's how I started to write the play. And then in terms of the language, which actually, I tried to be judicious right. in the use of sort of common or foul language. Saint Monica certainly, kind of has a foul mouth, but she comes and she's coming in the play from a certain place. But the other saints, I don't think they curse. I tried, but what was in my mind was to write the play because I was interested in myself in examination of faith, and then when I thought of my peers and people that were younger than me, especially. To write in a way that would make things accessible.
Right.
So I'm certainly not defending the language, but, Jesus hung around with, whores and sinners and gamblers and all those guys.
Fishermen,
yeah. and they got the salty language. Yeah. And so I just wanted to put it into a context that was hopefully accessible.
Right. And I saw the play, and it didn't offend me in any way. I mean, I felt like it was a fresh approach, because unfortunately a lot of these speeches and the words from the gospel, you've heard them so many times that you can't really hear them.
Right.
So when you wrote them in a way that made them, you could sort of hear the message, because it was a little shocking, but also new. Yeah.
And again, I remember talking to Father Jim, some other people, and people were concerned whether there'd be controversy.
Right.
About the play, and I said, well, if there's controversy, there is, we can't stop it, but it's, Jesus is not sleeping with Judas,
right.
It's like,
yeah.
Nobody's like, like,
that's where you get the trouble.
That's
right?
Where you get, yeah. And then with Little Flower, is just, I don't know, how they talk, certain characters, certainly the son and the daughter kind of have a foul mouth.
Yeah. Well, let me just give a quick plot summary for those of you who have not, listeners who have not seen the play. Little Flower of East Orange is the narrator is a writer whose mother has fallen ill and is in the hospital. At first, the doctors don't know who she is, and it's not clear whether she doesn't know or whether she's refusing to say. So, and it's about the relationship of the son who comes back to see the mother, and also the daughter, and some difficult truths that they kind of work through together. Now, that play, I want to read here a quote in the playbill that you get. You start here with a quote from St. Teresa of Lisieux, and I just want to read it. The splendor of the rose and the whiteness of the lily do not rob the little violet of its scent, nor the daisy of its simple charm. I realize that if every tiny flower wanted to be rose, spring would lose its loveliness, and there would be no wildflowers to make the meadows gay. Now, I was wondering why you decided to include that quote.
I found that quote and I put it at the top of the script that I was writing, mm-hmm. because it produced a feeling in me. And then I decided to put it in the playbill, well, for a couple of reasons. The main character, Therese Marie, was named after the little flower.
Sure.
And actually, she always preferred the other Therese of Avila, because she was a little more feisty, could be outspoken. And, I mean, Saint Therese is obviously such a lovely, lovely, lovely... She died, I think, before she was 30.
Yeah.
You know, very kind of saintly in that traditional sense. That's a tall order to live up to, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that in some ways the character in the play was sort of groomed by her father to, you know, and named after the saint to sort of basically... You know, you're going to bear this burden and be this, because this is what we want you to be. So that the idea of Therese and the idea of that quote is sort of a double-edged sword. It's a loving sword, because I think the quote is beautiful when she says, you know, about how, you know, we all have a part to play, and, you know, some are kings and some are, you know. But at the other end, there's a level of humility and selflessness in that quote that would take, I think, divine intervention to truly own and not have it be something that you feel you have to be. And I think that's part of the struggle, central struggle in the family, dealing with sort of sainthood and martyrdom and how they commingle.
Yeah. Now, this play, is, as I said, is about a writer. You're a writer. And it felt very personal. Was it difficult for you to write?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly autobiographical elements in the play, as I would say to everything that I write. But there are some aspects that are more overtly, identifiably autobiographical. You know, I had a mother, she died. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother's father was a deaf alcoholic.
Okay.
And actually, if you write on the playbill, that's that plaque... Right now, right there.
Oh, okay, right here, yeah.
Is my grandfather did an incredible amount of work for the Catholic deaf organizations, and he got a plaque from the Pope, and it was interesting because he was very beloved and acknowledged for a lot of amazing efforts that he put out for the deaf community and the Catholic community. But, you know, there was some issues with alcohol and violence and... I forgot what the question was.
No, we were just talking about it. It was difficult.
I mean, when I started writing the play, my mother was alive, and she read about the first 40 pages, and then suddenly she got sick, and she died, and you know, life changed immediately. And my dad is an older fellow, so that's why I'm here. I moved in back with him, and the last thing I wanted to do was write anything, let alone go back and write this play. But my theater company, you know, they were expecting a play.
Right.
And the theater was expecting a play. So I went, and I prayed about it a bit, and I realized that if this is something that's in front of me to do, it can't be for a negative reason. There has to be. So I said, well, let me go at it and maybe... You know, it'll come out not well, or maybe it'll come out okay, but to just try to do it. And so the doing of it was difficult, but once I committed to that, then, you know, it got not easier, but I felt that, you know, the act of writing was attached to a certain purpose, and that helped.
And that's something that is explored in the play at the beginning, that the narrator, that the writer says that he's been told to tell his story, because... The idea is that in the telling, he can come to understand it or come to grips with it. And it sounds like a similar experience for you, was, you know, going through this process, maybe partially therapeutic in a way.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I'm actually rewriting the play.
You are? Okay.
When this closes, we're going to do a workshop, and then I think do the play out of town, and then bring it back to New York in a larger venue. So
we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, we'll see where it goes.
Now, one of the themes that you touch upon the play is a very Catholic one, of grace. Now, somebody who's perhaps not Catholic, might look at these characters who are dealing with some difficult issues, as you said, alcoholism, illness, drug addiction, might be hard-pressed to see moments of grace. Yet that's very much at the center of the play. What is your definition of grace?
What's my definition of grace? I don't think I could define it in a sentence or two. I can maybe give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
And I'll try to just be brief. When I found out that my mother was dying, my sister called me and she's like, "Meet me right now." And they're, you know, she's like, "Cancer, you know, a month or two to live." Yeah. And then I had to tell my mother. I called Father Jim Martin, who was a friend.
Yeah.
And I called another friend, and they were there in 20 minutes. And went into the room, and it was like, there's not much more difficult than to walk into a room and, you know, say to your mother, you know, you're dying and you're not going to live very long. It's very difficult. But I have Father Jim, my friend Yul Vasquez, with me, and I told her, and they were there, and then Father Jim did the last rites, and he was doing the last rites, and something happened. It was a difficult situation, and I had just come from a summer of great difficulty, but all of a sudden there was an awareness. I don't know how to describe it. It's like when the tension leaves your shoulders.
Yeah.
When your breath is not constricted, and there was an overwhelming sense of, this is going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fun, but it's going to be okay. That, to me, is grace made vividly present, because I didn't do anything to have it. It just came. And an example, what I would think of as grace, but where it's not so visibly present, that you have to dig it out a little bit, is while I was writing Judas. And I have, I go through a ridiculous storm and drang about writing, and it's ridiculous. And I had to write some pages, and it had to be in the morning, and I hadn't slept, and I went and took a little nap, and I woke up, and I had a toothache. And I had a toothache that, like, not like, oh, my tooth kind of hurts a little bit. It was like, you know, when you have a toothache, and it's like, it's the only thing your consciousness can acknowledge, because it's just, and I went through the closet, tried to find all the little toothache aids I could find, you know, and I think it was like I got a couple of aspirin, and I was like, oh, and I was looking for the 24-hour dentist, all this stuff, and I was like, I'm in trouble now, because there's no way I'm going to be able to write, and I have to have this stuff in the morning, and my tooth, and this and that, and I sat down at my desk, and I was really in pain. I mean, there's no question, and I turned on the computer, and I was just looking at the script, and I started writing. And I started writing and writing and writing. And all of a sudden, if it was 3 in the morning, it was noon, you know. And I wrote a lot, and my tooth didn't hurt anymore. Now, what that said to me was, like, it doesn't say to me that God took away the toothache and blew grace dust into the room. But what happened was, there it was like I had a choice. And I chose to, like, look at the work, and then the rest happened. And that it was perhaps not a particularly profound understanding to me, but it showed me that the toothache was actually an opportunity.
Yeah.
That there was two ways to look at it. And also made me think that if I had woke up and I didn't have a toothache, the chances are I would have turned around and went back to sleep.
Right.
But the toothache made me deal with my reality, and then I was able to do something different, and then the thing went away. So that, to me, is also an example of grace. But it's the grace, you know, I think that grace is always there, like he says at the end of the play, and it's always present, it never goes away. Just get at the end of Judas, how Jesus is with Judas, and you get the sense that he never leaves him, you know. And sometimes we get lucky and the grace just comes, you know, and we might blow it off, we might ignore it, or we might accept it. But certainly a little bit of a tiny bit of work on our part opens the floodgates, and it's there.
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard to portray it in a work of a play or a you know, a book. I was reminded while watching the play of the George Bernanos, The Diary of a Country Priest, where it's about a priest who's working in the French countryside. He's not very popular. He has a difficult life. He becomes sick, winds up dying. But the last words of the book are, "Grace is everywhere." And I was reminded of your play because it's like all these difficult, terrible things happen, but yet the final message is that grace is there.
And, you know, another thing, too, is that people in trying, difficult circumstances, you know, I mean, grace is on the alert there, you know.
Right,
it's like,
yeah,
it's always the, you know, right, it's you know, it's there when things are sort of okay. But I think that God, or however you want to identify that power, is benevolently opportunistic, not like, oh, you know, but benevolently, you know, that support is there.
Now, another theme in the play is suicide. One character makes what can be read as a suicide attempt. Another is persuaded against committing suicide. And as Father Jim reminded me, in Last Days of Judas Iscariot, you explore the reasons for Judas's suicide and whether that, what are the consequences of that. Why did you return to this subject?
It wasn't conscious.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the case of Judas involved a suicide, so we had to examine that,
right, yeah,
you know, and that and it was helpful to do so. In this play, it was you know, it was something that frankly it was something my mother used to say,
yeah,
you know, towards the end of her life, is that she always wanted to die, you know, and thankfully I've learned that my mother is not the only mother that would, you know, sing that song, but she would say it very, very, very earnestly. The only reason she doesn't commit suicide is because it's a sin against the church,
yeah,
and this and that. And which, frankly, was an incredible source of frustration for me. Not because, like, you know, the obvious mom, it's not a good idea for mothers to, you know, tell their children how much they wish they were dead.
Yeah.
Not that. But my mother was a very good Catholic, a very strong Catholic. Her faith in God was exceedingly strong. Her worldview was informed by her belief in God. You know, Father Jim, first time he met her, you know, he was like, this woman is godly, you know,
yeah,
it's just there's God in her, you know. And yet, she was never able to ask God for help with some of these issues. You know, it's like, I would say, well, talk to God about this.
Yeah.
You know, ask God, if you don't know why you're here, ask God. And her faith is so much stronger than mine. I mean, a really good, good person. But their inability to do that, you know, it was very frustrating, you know, and very provoking of difficult questions in me about, then what is that? You know, what is that? And what is the, if one of your, like, you know, pretty good soldiers, you know, doesn't know how to pick up a phone, you know, or doesn't feel it's okay to pick up the phone,
right,
like, then
what does that mean for,
yeah,
yeah, for you and for faith in general? Yeah. As we've discussed, the play Little Flower is very much about family loyalty, what we owe to the people who raised us, and how family narratives can be kind of construed in ways to fit our own needs.
Yeah.
The past looms very large in this play. Do you think that we can escape the past, or should we even bother trying?
Well, I mean, certainly all of us are informed by our past and the past of our parents, and I think that, you know, some people are more successful than others at separating. I mean, I certainly look at both my parents and what they've given me, and the positive things they've given me are really positive, and really, I'm really grateful. And I don't know, I guess the job evolution and, you know, self-evolution or family evolution is, you know, as each generation goes on, to try to retain the gifts and work through some of the challenges so that you pass on to your child, you know, a little less of, you know, of the vinegar and a little more of the sugar. I don't know. I would say that, because my mother is Irish-American, my father is Egyptian. Both of them are very, very, very family-oriented. That it's especially the notion of family and what that means and what's expected of you, and it's very, very deep.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, at least in Little Flower, it's unclear whether the family pull is a good thing for the main character, the narrator, because he, you know, it sort of pulls him. He refuses to leave his mother, but he also knows that that relationship is at least partially destructive. I won't give away what happens at the end, but, you know, he goes through some difficult moments there. It's unclear whether, you know, family loyalty is important, but it also can be damaging.
Yeah, but then it's also like what we project on family. You know, the character of Danny in the play, you know, attaches all the significance to, you know, I'm not going to leave my mother because she needs me, you know, but there's another side to it of maybe, you know, he needs to face certain fears, certain issues in this, and devotion to the family is a way to block out those things that he doesn't want to examine in himself.
Yeah.
You know, there's always a balance. I think that the, you know, the difference between the character of the son in the play and the character of the daughter in the play is just very simply that the daughter has made a what I think is a sane attempt to have some boundaries, whereas the son, you know, hasn't been able to do that, which I think we see in the play is something that the mother was unable to do with her father. So that's a little bit of the apple falling close to the tree.
Sure. I should note here that the mother in the play is played by Ellen Burstyn, who is obviously a great Hollywood actress, and she does a great job in this role. She really nails it. Yeah.
She's an amazing, amazing person first. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and then obviously a gifted actor. But it's amazing. She's 75, I believe.
Oh, really?
And from day one, is all she cared about was to be great and
yeah.
serve the play. And her energy and enthusiasm and commitment, very educational.
Yeah.
You know, inspirational, educational. And, yeah, she's fantastic.
And she really nails that certain kind of slightly passive-aggressive mother who, you know, is very sweet, but also, you know, is always able to get that little criticism in there, and it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Father Jim brought this up. I mean, certain sections of Little Flower feel very kind of Eugene O'Neill. I mean, that you're dealing with Irish characters, problems with drinking, you know, that the past looms large. I mean, is he an influence? Are there other writers that you look to that influence you?
The writers that influence me. I mean, not Eugene O'Neill directly,
yeah.
you know, with this play, although I know it's a family play.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have to say the writer that most influenced me or most touched me when I was younger was Tennessee Williams.
Okay.
And he was the first sort of playwright other than Shakespeare that I became aware of, and I did The Glass Menagerie when I was in high school, and I was always moved by his work, that there could be a marriage between coarseness and fragility, and I don't know. So he's just kind of always stayed with me, and I'd say that he was definitely more of like an inspiration. You know, that someday if I could write a play that would let the audience feel at the end of it the way I felt, you know, when I saw, you know, Streetcar, or when I read Streetcar or Glass Menagerie or any number of one of his plays. I'd say he's number one, but certainly, you know, there's a lot of great playwrights. Clifford Odets as
yeah.
well is one that I really like.
And there's a revival of his now in the city, right? Country Girl.
The Country Girl,
yeah.
Yeah, but the last one they did, I forgot, it was about a year and a half ago with Mark Ruffalo.
Okay.
I forgot. Awake and Sing. It was incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so moving and so inspiring.
We've talked about The Last Days of Judas Iscariot. That was a play in which you had to kind of put words in the mouths of biblical characters, which must have been a real challenge. Was it a relief to go back to writing for average people?
I mean, it was different, but it wasn't so... Judas, it was daunting. I tried to make them as much average people as I could.
Right.
You know, Peter, at the end of the day, you know, fisherman. you know, Matthew, at the end of the day, he was a tax collector, and his whole life changed in 1 second because, you know, somebody looked him in the eye and said, you know, come with me. And, you know, like, so this, yeah, I mean, but this was it kind of into out of the frying pan into the fire.
Right.
Because I went from writing about, you know, the origin of a, you know, fairly deep dilemma that's been ingrained in me, and then going into loosely autobiographical, but, you know, so both challenging.
We were talking before that your play, Last Days of Judas Iscariot, is now playing in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And in London as well. So perhaps some of our listeners can check it out. And you, as you said, you're going to be working...
And in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago, too.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And you're going to be working again on Little Flower, and that might come back to New York and be in other cities as well.
Oh, yeah, it'll certainly be in other cities, and the plan is that we want to bring it back. I feel like... I mean, I certainly wouldn't dissuade anybody from coming to see the play. It's, I mean, it's running for another 5 days. In fact, I would offer a money-back guarantee to any America Magazine listeners who come in the next 5 days and really feel like it was a rip-off. But, so I'm not, I feel good about what's there.
Yeah.
But I think that there's more work to be done. And myself and Alan and Phil and Oscar, who runs the public, everyone's behind the notion of, like, let's take the next step and see what's what.
Well, that's a good window into how playwriting works. It's an organic process. It takes time. Sometimes it takes a couple of drafts to get through to what you
sure.
mean. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. A lot of times plays don't open in New York, you know. You
right.
open out of town and you have a chance to make mistakes, you know, in
right.
Oklahoma
right.
as opposed to, you know, on West 4th Street.
Right. And Phil, you said Philip Seymour Hoffman is the director, and he has directed a number of your plays.
Yeah, basically all of them. All of them. He's an amazing. He's an amazing guy. Really, he's a great. We have a friend, Frank Vitolo, who's a born again Christian. Grew up Catholic. He's a born again Christian, and he often describes Phil as the most Christian person he knows.
Wow.
And I think to a large degree that's true. But in any case, he's a great director and a great person to work with. And I think part of that reason is because of the qualities that our friend Frank ascribes to him.
Yeah.
You know, he has a great forcefulness when that's needed, but he also approaches the work with the writer and with the actor with humility and respect. And both of us work really hard to do the best that we can.
On that note, we just want to say thank you to Stephen Adley Gierges for joining us. I know you're busy and you're suffering from a bad back, so thanks for taking the time.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. And again, the play will be running through May 4th?
May 4th.
May 4th this Sunday, so you've got the guarantees to
money back guarantee. Tim can get in touch with me.
So go out and see it. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. Remind you that you can subscribe to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com, where you can also leave us comments, which we will occasionally read on the air. We also want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.